Before I begin today's episode, I have to talk about events that happened this week in the United States. January the 6th was an interesting day in the U.S. While I tend not to shy away from making political statements on my podcast, I don't dwell on them, because it's not fun to listen to someone rant about politics when you come for the Wheel of Time, but I do take my pot shots when I can to shit-talk my country, and I do that partly because I'm frustrated. I'm a frustrated American. And I do that partly because not all of my audience is from the U.S. A significant percentage of it is not, and I want to speak to the entire globe and kind of make room for everyone else and not exist in such a state of American exceptionalism. You know, I grow up in a crass culture where we are only ever thinking about ourselves, and we just assume that the world revolves around us because that's what we're taught to think. And so I want to scoot over and make room. And there are people in the Watt community that have complained about people on Twitter of time, or they complain occasionally about content creators making political statements and commenting about things, whether in the Trump administration or different events that have happened over the last couple of years, the Supreme Court nominations, etc. Seth from Watt Spoilers has made comments talking shit about Trump over the course of his podcast, and I know that people have complained about it. I don't know that I ever specifically called out Trump in any of my episodes, just mentioned that I'm living in a giant trash fire right now, just shit-talked America in general. I am distressingly frustrated with my country and the divisions in it, the general stupidity of the people as a whole, which is something that has so many different causes. From the fact that our education system is garbage and has been systematically defunded for years and years and is undervalued, and teachers don't get paid anything and aren't valued, and being intelligent is disincentivized, intellectuals are branded as being superior snobs, and so there is this division, basically. The wealthy do this bait and switch to try to get the poor to fight amongst each other so they can fuck us all over, which I guess is a trick as old as time. But I've been very frustrated, especially over the last 20 or so years, with the rhetoric that it began to come out around the time of George W. Bush, where it was, we need to be fair and balanced, we need to be fair and balanced. And that was a bullshit trick that was pulled to gaslight the left and make them feel like they were unreasonable to say that, no, there is right and there is wrong, and you can try to politicize things and act like that we can't talk about them because you've made them political. But, you know, the fact that I couldn't marry my wife until 2015, that's just wrong. It's not about politics, but when my everyday existence is politicized, then I guess everything is politics. And when people talk about privilege, it's like, if you live a life where you don't have to worry about politics affecting your day-to-day quality of life, that's what privilege is. I expected something like what happened on Wednesday. I've expected it the whole Trump administration, because he was building up to it. From day one, when he started being in office, he began attacking the sanctity of our elections. I'm assuming probably because he figured chances weren't great that he'd win re-election. The fact that he came so close was alarming, but that's the Democrats' fault. They forced Joe Biden on us. The last two elections, the Democrats have undercut the will of their constituents and forced centrist candidates on us, when people who are prone to vote Democrat don't really want that. We want more progressive candidates, and America is just strangled by its two-party system. And so what happened on Wednesday, while it's horrifying, is also, in many ways, and I'm not saying it lightly because people died, and that's bad, but People were hurt and killed throughout the Black Lives Matter movement all summer long, and so I can't feel sad for people who went and staged an insurrection to stop a lawful and fair election because they didn't want it to be what it was. And they will believe anything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. They will believe anything he tells them. Endless, endless, thousands and thousands of documented lies, easily provable lies, pour forth from his mouth, and they believe it. If Donald Trump told them I was wearing pants right now, they would believe it. And I'm not wearing pants, I assure you, but they would believe it. And I bet some of them would actually see me wearing pants. Plenty of them would know that I wasn't wearing pants, but they would say that I was anyway because they're sick, and it's sick. And the nice thing about Trump's presidency for me, I guess, is that it's made me much less tolerant of people's bullshit. And then COVID came along and destroyed any remaining tolerance for bullshit. I have no patience for anyone who apologizes for Trump. And I honestly don't have much patience for anyone who dislikes Trump but apologizes for people who apologize for him. What happened on Wednesday is what happens when people apologize for Trump. What happened on Wednesday is what happens when people apologize for the apologists. And at this point, his strongest supporters are what my wife calls TFGs, the too far gones. They live in a world of QAnon and Pizzagate and insanity, and their reality is not the same, and it's frightening and scary, and they're a snarl of Holocaust deniers and conspiracy theorists and nutbags and women who basically think that he's Jesus, and on, just crazy, crazy people. And they follow him and they do what he says. Sure, we'll do an insurrection, and so many of them because he's a bumbling fucking idiot, because we were fortunate enough when we did get our autocrat to get a fucking bumbling idiot, a crybaby narcissist rather than one that was actually, you know, truly terrifying and effective, and Trump was terrifying enough. You know, all of those fucking fools breaking into the Capitol building, taking selfies and everything. I bet the FBI is having a field day right now tracking them all down, and I'm guessing it's pretty fucking easy because they were all so dumb. It was a tragedy because people died, but I think that good will come of it too, because while not all of the Republicans stopped being, you know, 11th hour moral cowards, enough of them did to infuriate the diehard Trump supporters who are screaming bloody murder and basically saying that they've lost millions of voters. And I think that the Republican Party is pretty much over, which was inevitable once Trump took over. And because of that, progressives don't have to stick with Democrats anymore. I think over the next 5 years, we'll probably be able to have maybe even 4 viable parties, which would be lovely because Joe Biden is a conservative in any country but the U.S., and he was forced on us, just like Hillary Clinton was forced on us. You know, we wanted Bernie Sanders, and, you know, it's bullshit. It seemed to be at least a wake-up call for some of the people who couldn't help themselves but continue to egg Trump on. And it doesn't stop them from being moral cowards. It seems to go hand in hand. And, you know, I'm assuming that I will eventually get enough listeners that this is going to hit a sore spot with someone. And so I am going to have to say, I don't care. Wednesday was proof that all along what we crybaby snowflake libtards have been saying, Donald Trump wasn't about politics. It was just about right and wrong. It was always just about right and wrong. And it was wrong. It was always wrong. You know, and I could forgive someone grudgingly for voting for Trump the first time if they were ashamed of themselves and regretted it. But doing it again, you know, that shows to me a fundamental moral failing, an unwillingness to actually look at a situation and be like, this is wrong. And I don't know. It's troubling. And I'm hopeful because I'm a realistic optimist. And I know that sometimes it takes turmoil to get positive growth. So I am hoping that we saw the end of the two-party system in what happened on Wednesday. And I guess I wouldn't have been able to take it with such equanimity if the Democrats hadn't won both of the Senate seats in Georgia, but I guess that made it easier. I hope that my country can pull its head out of its ass, because at this point I wonder why we continue being one. I just sort of feel like we might do better as individual states. I don't know. But I just wanted to address what happened because it's fucked up and it's gotta be talked about. And if you supported Donald Trump, it's wrong. And if you think that that lawful, fair election was stolen, you're wrong. And if you believe every word that pours out of Donald Trump's mouth, that's crazy.
The stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to the 16th episode of Podcast of the Dragon. Have you ever made a decision that was so colossally stupid it haunted you? Are you really bad at being evil, even if you're capable of doing it? Have you ever regretted terrible choices that you made? Then you, too, might be a really poor candidate to swear your soul to the shadow. Today, we're going to talk about Ingtar, a very nice guy who got super depressed and didn't think through his life choices very clearly.
Throughout the entire saga that is The Wheel of Time, Robert Jordan shows us lots of different dark friends with all sorts of different motivations. We have the three main motivations, which seem to be a desire for immortality or wealth or power. We get the desire for advancement, which isn't quite the same as a desire for power. Somebody who wants advancement doesn't necessarily want to rule over or control others. They just want to have more glory or acclaim for themselves. You get people who become dark friends out of a desire for vengeance, out of envy, because they want greater outlets for their sadistic cruelty. You get people who are incidental recruits, who are put into situations where it's like, join us or die. Demandred frees Mazrim Taim and is like, you can become a dark friend or I can kill you. And Taim is like, well, I'm a piece of shit anyway, so it's not like it's asking a lot. You get people who are inducted because dark friends do them a favor, and then they're like, how about you do us a favor? If you read the Wheel of Time companion entry for Alviarin, that's kind of what happened to her. She kills a girl, and then Dark Friends help her cover it up. And then they're like, hey, want to kill this person for us? A favor for a favor? And since Alviarin's basically a garden variety psychopath, she has no ambitions for wealth or power or immortality. She's just a bad person, and she wants to be a bad person. Being a Dark Friend suits her just fine. You have people who were born into families of Dark Friends, like Pater, the young bubbling Dark Friend, and Market Sharon, who Rand punches in the face. You have Dark Friends like Leandrin, who were shitheads from a very young age and eagerly became Dark Friends, and she was actively seeking the Black Aja from the moment that she came to the White Tower. RJ shows us so many different types of people. And then you have Lord Ingtar. One of the things that makes him such a compelling character is that he is very early proof that Dark Friends are not so simple. Sometimes RJ gives us kind of cookie-cutter stereotypes of certain categories of people, and he roots a lot of those stereotypes in logical premises. It makes sense that lots of the people who decide to become Dark Friends are ones who want immortality. Fear of death is definitely a very understandable motivation, almost more than wanting power or wanting money or wanting to get back at someone, wanting to have more than someone, just being a horrible, cruel person, being bona fide evil, all the other different kinds of things. So, to have very early on a Dark Friend like Ingtar, we see a handful of Dark Friends in The Great Hunt, and we get to explore their characters, whether from small POVs or from knowing them through our POV characters. RJ introduces us at the very beginning of the prologue to the man who calls himself Bors, and so we see a shithead Dark Friend in him, with the most base motivations, the desire for power and immortality. We see a small POV from Leandrin that shows us someone who is an unkind and manipulative and just terrible human, and we learn more about her through the eyes of Egwene and Moraine. And then because Leandrin is a character that continues to be explored, you don't see Carradine, Jacob Carradine, the man who calls himself Bors again until the prologue of The Dragon Reborn. It's like Ingtar exists as a quiet foil to Leandrin, so the two of them are like your actual, you know, Dark Friend pair in the story. You suspect about Leandrin. You suspect that she is Black Aja because she's so sketchy, but I almost feel like RJ made her so blatantly terrible so that she'd be like a red herring. Everyone would be like, there's no way that Leandrin is Black Aja because she's so awful. That would be too obvious. And so you might be surprised at the end that she was evil because you'd be like, there's no way she could be evil. She's so terrible. Or maybe you weren't surprised and I'm just naive. Ingtar gets to move through the story with motivations that seem clear on the surface. He's a Borderlander, and a Borderlander fighting the Shadow would be determined to find the Horn of Valir when it's stolen. But when you get the big reveal at the end, looking back at his motivations, they're much more muddy, because it's not just outrage at an artifact being stolen and feeling desperate to find it because the Shadow possessing it imperils everything, or the sense of violation that the Keep has been invaded, or any of that. You learn that he's fighting for his salvation. So Ingtar is a unique kind of Dark Friend. We never again are explicitly faced with a character who turns to the Shadow because of despair. We are privy to his mood throughout the time we know him, and he is not subtle. He's not a positive guy. And you're not expecting Borderlanders to be filled with joy and having it all be sunshine and puppies. They're serious people, raised in a serious land, faced with serious issues, and they don't fuck around. But to get an idea of the kinds of thoughts that rattle around in his head, and just the general musings that he engages in, he puts it into words as the hunters are into their second or third day hunting the Horn, and they're riding past the leftovers of the Hardani Manor House, and Loyal gives this short history of all these forgotten nations, and talks about how it's 300 years since the nation of Hardan fell, and how the manor house was within a city called Haradikar. And Ingtar says, "The city was hauled away, stone by stone. All faded away, and what is not gone is fading. Everything. Everywhere fading. There is hardly a nation that truly controls the land it claims on a map, and there is hardly a land that claims today on a map what it did even 100 years ago. When the War of the 100 Years ended, a man rode from one nation into another without end, from the Blight to the Sea of Storms. Now we can ride through wilderness claimed by no nation for almost the whole of the land.
We in the Borderlands have our battle with the Blight to keep us strong and whole. Perhaps they did not have what they needed to keep them strong. You say they failed, Builder? Yes, they failed. And what nation standing whole today will fail tomorrow? We are being swept away, humankind. Swept away like flotsam on a flood. How long until there is nothing left but the Borderlands? How long before we too go under and there is nothing left but Trollocs and Murdrel all the way to the Sea of Storms? So that lets us know the philosophical ruminations that run through him. He's a Borderland lord, likely sworn to fight the Shadow from birth. We first get a glimpse of his gloomy demeanor when he escorts the crew to the Blight border for their trip to the Eye of the World at the end of the first book, and we see a bit more of him and his attitude. It's the first time he really expresses himself beyond escorting the party to Lord Aghalmar or bringing Fane to them, performing attendant-type duties that don't show us anything really of who he is. But here, it says, Inktar lifted a steel fist to halt the lances short of a plain stone post inside of the towers, a border post marking the boundary between Shinar and what once was Malkir. Your pardon, Moraine Aes Sedai. Pardon, Daishan. Pardon, Builder. Lord Aghalmar commanded me to go no further. He sounded unhappy about it, disgruntled at life in general. That is as we planned, Lord Aghalmar and I, Moraine said. Inktar grunted sourly. Pardon, Aes Sedai, he apologized, not sounding as if he meant it. To escort you here means we may not reach the gap before the fighting is done. I am robbed of the chance to stand with the rest, and at the same time I am commanded not to ride one step beyond the border post, as if I had never before been in the Blight, and my Lord Aghalmar will not tell me why. Behind the bars of his face guard, his eyes turned the last word into a question to the Aes Sedai. He scorned to look at Rand and the others. He had learned they would accompany Lon into the Blight. He can have my place, Matt muttered to Rand. Lon gave them both a sharp look. Matt dropped his eyes, his face turning red. Each of us has his part in the pattern, Inktar, Moraine said firmly. From here we must thread ours alone. Inktar's bow was stiffer than his armor made it. As you wish it, Aes Sedai. I must leave you now and ride hard in order to reach Tarwyn's Gap. At least I will be allowed to face Trollocs there. Are you truly that eager, Nynaeve asked, to fight Trollocs? Inktar gave her a puzzled look, then glanced at Lon as if the warder might explain. That is what I do, lady, he said slowly. That is why I am. As we come to know Inktar through the Great Hunt, we can kind of look at what he's saying there, and we can surmise the whispering despair of his internal narrative, particularly at that point in the story. He's leading them into the Blight. The Trollocs and Murdrel raids have been horrific all through the winter. There was no abatement to it, and now Trollocs and Murdrel are gathering in the Gap. All of the farms have emptied out, they're all gathered in Faldar Keep, and when the lances ride to the Gap, all of the people are going to flee toward Fal Moran. Aghalmar was really excited to see Lon and Moraine show up, because he thought that Lon would raise the Golden Crane banner, and so people would come to help, and that Moraine would use the power to help them fight. And so when he learned no, they weren't going to help, and they were going to the Eye of the World instead, because that's where the real battle was, he was like, well, shit, if you can't help us, maybe I'll send people with you. And she's like, no, you've got your battle, we've got ours. So right now, especially, Inktar's got a super gloomy mindset, because they've been screwed. They know the realities of living in the Borderlands, and some of it is so ugly. Dealing with Shadowspawn is horrible. And I can just imagine the whispering despair of Inktar's internal narrative at this point, because he's like, I'm not even going to be able to make it to the Gap to fight and fall with my friends. I'm going to run into the Horde with my small group of men after, once it's already too late, and there's nothing to be done. And so I imagine him thinking after he finishes saying, this is why I am, you know, to kill the Trollocs is why I am, silently finishing in his head, but what's the point? We don't know much about Inktar. We don't know his age. We know he has to be at least 30, because when Rand describes the Shiner and soldiers, he says that Regan is the youngest, and that Regan is nearly 10 years older than he is. So we know that Regan is probably about 28, and I always see Inktar being between 30 and 35. I don't think that he's past his mid-30s, because he's too cocky. When they first arrive in Faldara, and they're talking to Lord Aghalmar, Moraine says, Inktar seems to believe you will defeat this threat as you've defeated many others across the years. Aes Sedai, Aghalmar said wryly. If Inktar had to ride alone to Tarwyn's Gap, he would ride the whole way proclaiming that the Trollocs would be turned back once more. He has almost pride enough to believe he could do it alone. He is not as confident as you think this time, Agilmar. The warder held a cup, but he did not drink. How bad is it? The way that Agilmar speaks of him makes him sound young, so I don't think he could be more than 35, and I think he's probably closer to his lower 30s. There's no mention of family. None of the soldiers in the crew of Shinarans that Rand travels with to hunt the Horn seem to be married. Hurin is married, but he's not a soldier. He's a sniffer, he's a thief-taker, and an agent of the Crown, but definitely not a soldier. Often it seems like, depending on the rules of the land, soldiers aren't allowed to be married. And while rules seem to be different for lords and officers, you see among the Saldaeans, the wives of the lords and officers come with them when they go off to fight, but you don't even know, do the common men have wives? Do those wives just stay home? I mean, who knows? But my headcanon is kind of that Ingtar is the younger son of House Shannawa, maybe even like a third son, so that his parents have had the heir and the spare, and so he isn't under the pressure of being married or continuing the line. And so it's more acceptable that he can be a soldier and die in the Blight. And that's what I see him as, is a young 30-something, at this point a very veteran soldier. All of the soldiers Ingtar brought were veterans. I think that was the point that RJ was making in saying that Regan was the youngest of them, because the Borderlands is not a place that would seem to have lots of older soldiers, considering how much fighting is done against the Blight. And RJ is someone who does make it a point later on, specifically with Gareth Bryn and his cadre of old soldiers, that veterans have great worth. Soldiers who are familiar with the art of war are extremely valuable, even if they're older. And so I think that though he does not discuss that in actual words this early in the series, the fact that Regan is the youngest and that he's nearly 30 is significant. We never know how long that Ingtar has been a dark friend, but I don't think that it's been a very long time. I'm guessing longer than the past year, though. In his confession to Rand at the end of the book, he says, "Humankind is being swept away everywhere. Nations fail and vanish. Dark friends are everywhere, and none of these Southlanders seem to notice or care. We fight to hold the Borderlands, to keep them safe in their homes, and every year, despite all we can do, the Blight advances, and these Southlanders think Trollocs are myths and murder a gleeman's tale." He frowned and shook his head. "It seemed the only way. We would be destroyed for nothing, defending people who do not even know or care. It seemed logical. Why should we be destroyed for them when we could make our own peace? Better the shadow, I thought, than useless oblivion like Carolane or Harden, or it seems so logical then." His use of the word "then" is ambiguous, so it could be a fairly recent development, but RJ is almost always surgical in his word choice, and I think that if Ingtar swearing to the shadow were super recent, like within the last couple of months or something, he would have left off the "then." Like, if he had just sworn right before he went to the Darkfront Social or something, I think that his word choice would have just been, "it seems so logical." To anybody thinking clearly, there is nothing logical about his thought process. The Dark One is called the Father of Lies for a reason. And even if Ingtar was explicitly promised when he swore his oath, the Borderlands will be spared fire and ruin when the last day comes, only a fucking idiot, particularly when one has been in the Blight and walked through the poisoned, ruined land of Malkyr, would believe that promise would be kept. But despair breaks down logic, and people's minds work differently, and they do crazy things in its grip. They start to think crazy things, and think that those things are well-reasoned. A person will commit a crime that may be serious, but certainly isn't worth dying for, and decide that it is better to kill themselves than face the consequences. And they think that that's logical. And they love their families, and hate to think of the shame they've brought them, and how their loved ones will suffer. And so, in the midst of their despair, some of those people follow that logical conclusion, and decide to kill their whole families, rather than force their families to live with the havoc that their suicide will wreak, and the stigma of their crimes. People in despair have logic that leads them to conclusions that are so insane, so nonsensical, like where there are so many other ways, like other things that you could do. Like, you do not have to do those things. There is no reason for you to do those things. And it's just sort of like, in much the same way that there is no real logic to tie you to the Dark One, not unless you're real fucking evil and you want a free pass to be evil, and that's the best path forward for you. Like, there are a handful of reasons why it might be logical for someone to become a Dark Friend if they have very dark purposes that they want to engage in, and that being a Dark Friend would facilitate that. But for someone like Ingtar, that kind of logic, to tie himself to the Dark One, that is not the kind of logic that a person would come to in a moment of sobriety? I wonder? Like, looking at his claim that Dark Friends are everywhere, it's interesting because I'm considering how the Borderlanders act toward people who are complicit with the Shadow. At the end of the Eye of the World, Moraine and crew get to Faldara, and they're shown to Aglemar, and Aglemar is talking about how things were bad all winter and how everything is going to shit in the Cap, and gee, I thought you guys were here to help us, but guess not, never mind. He talks about how five of their people were caught trying to saw through the hinges of a gate, and they don't even know that they were Dark Friends because those people were torn to pieces before they could be questioned. Just on the suspicion, because they were doing something as sketchy as trying to saw open a gate where Trollocs could get through, which is, frankly, really suspicious. So, faced with that type of passion and anger and rage toward Dark Friends, the pure fury that would get them to the point where they tore five people to pieces, I'm just wondering, how do you come across other Dark Friends? Like, how do they find each other? And so, how do you become a Dark Friend? Like, is there some kind of dark rite? Like, can you swear by yourself in a dark ritual? Like, Dark One, wherever you may be, take this soul of mine far away from me. Somehow, I imagine that Ingtar came to the conclusion while drinking, and that swearing to the Shadow for him is kind of like getting a tattoo, because you can't ever get rid of it. And he was like, I thought it was a good idea at the time, and then I kind of woke up, or came out of it, or sobered up, or whatever, and was like, oh, shit. Only it's the kind of tattoo like getting a dick tattooed on your face or something. Like, a real, real bad choice. Not even something that you could live with reasonably and ever feel okay about it. When we see Ingtar at the Dark Friend social, we're getting the unreliable narrator in Bors, aka Jacob Carradine. And Carradine is imagining greedy, ambitious people. He's looking around and he's judging everyone, putting motivations to everyone, and imagining everyone being much like himself, except far inferior, because Jacob Carradine's an asshole. But I think Ingtar being there, Ingtar must feel much more conflicted. I think just like Carradine, he has to be looking at everybody and judging them. And I think rather than being like, I'm so much more superior than them, and so many of them will be gone before the day of return, and I will triumph, and mwahaha, Ingtar has to be feeling sick and creeped out and thinking, I am nothing like these people. These people are my enemies. These people are not okay. Ingtar is probably feeling this overwhelming sense of stranger danger. He's a month out from the battle at Tarwyn's Gap that he missed by an hour, and a battle that he is very disgruntled to have missed. He swore to the Shadow, thinking it was the only way to save Shinar. And I don't know if when he swore they were like, what's your one wish, or something, and he's like, I want peace, a separate peace made for us, the Borderlands, with the Shadow. Save us, fuck everybody else. And the Dark One was like, you got it, bro. And then he was hoping for some kind of miracle in Tarwyn's Gap, something to show proof that his oaths were working. And then there was a miracle in Tarwyn's Gap, and so I don't know if he's just disgruntled to have missed the miracle. It says, Ingtar's was the first face Rand saw that was not smiling, because everybody's smiling at the end of the Eye of the World. Spring has come, and they're all dancing in the streets because there was a miracle in the Gap. I was too late, Ingtar told Lom with a sour grimace. Too late by an hour to see. Peace. His teeth ground audibly. Maybe he thought what happened in the Gap was proof that his pledge had worked or was worth it. Because Jordan gives us so little about Ingtar, it's really hard to guess what his Dark Friend tasks might have been before he gets his orders at the Dark Friend social. I really don't think that he's a fresh-minted Dark Friend, but I also don't know that I think that he's done much in the way of officially sanctioned evil before they're all called together in Ashamiel's Dream Shard. So maybe he's like a Dark Friend sleeper, and this is the first time that he was activated? When he confesses to Rand, He explains the obsession that he has had in finding the horn. He's been desperate to find it. It was bad enough when they were first riding out and he was trying to catch up to it the same day. And Uno was like, yo, you're going to kill our horses. And then when Rand and Huron and Loyal disappeared, he's freaking the fuck out until Perrin tells him, yo, I can talk to wolves. They'll track them for you. And then they finally catch up in Kai Rian and he's like, you fucking found it, Rand. And Rand's like, they stole it back. And Ingtar says, I'll fucking kill Barthanas. I'll make him talk. And then he finds out it's going to Toman Head, and he's like, I'm lost. He's just getting more and more frantic, more desperate. And he explains it to Rand. For the first time, Ingtar looked at Rand. His eyes shone with unshed tears. You are a better man than I, shepherd or lord, a better man. The prophecy says, let who sounds me think not of glory, but only salvation. It was my salvation I was thinking of. I would sound the horn and lead the heroes of the ages against Shale Ghul. Surely that would have been enough to save me. No man can walk so long in the shadow that he cannot come again to the light. That is what they say. Surely that would have been enough to wash away what I have been and done. The two tasks that we know he gets from the Darkfront Social are that he needs to let a gray man into the keep and that he needs to free Padden Fane. So letting the gray man into the keep and freeing Fane, and in particular what he had to do to free him, and in doing all of that being the reason that the horn was stolen in the first place, I'm wondering if those actually were the extent of his sins in the service to the Shadow. And as for what he has been, people punish themselves all the time for being bad people. Even if they're not, they punish themselves for having negative thoughts, for not being enough, for weakness, for drinking, for not making their parents proud. I don't know that Ingtar has a litany of sins that we're not privy to. I just wonder if Ingtar is so ashamed of himself and what he's been and what he's not been, and maybe most of all that he was weak and did something crazy in a moment of weakness. And I'm imagining him at the Dark Friend Social, so uncomfortable, just disgusted and grossed out by the Zamora, the creepy blonde waiters with the vacant eyes, the whole weird dreamscape that is being in the Dream Shard, and probably deeply regretting choices, looking at that tattoo of a dick on his face and thinking, dear light, what have I done? In the prologue, Jacob Carradine describes Ingtar. It says, the man's carriage named him Soldier. The set of his shoulders, the way his gaze never rested in one place for long, and the way his hand seemed ready to dart for a sword that was not there, all proclaimed it. The Shinaran wasted little time on the man who called himself Bors. Stooped shoulders and a bent back held no threat. The man who called himself Bors snorted as the Shinaran moved on, right hand clenching and eyes already studying elsewhere for danger. No one at the Dark Friend Social is relaxed. They were all summoned because Ashamiel has tasks of fuckery that he wants to delegate to them, but because Ingtar's motivation is so different from most of the Dark Friends that we meet throughout the series, I see him feeling especially out of place. At the Dark Friends Social, Baalzamon has brought the Dark Friends into a Dream Shard, which he uses with great effect to suitably impress them. Ashamiel is all about dramatic presentation. He manipulates it to show Matt, Perrin, and Rand hanging in the air. And it says, dead silence had fallen, silence that Baalzamon let deepen before he spoke. There is now one who walks the world, one who was and will be, but is not yet the dragon. A startled murmur ran through his listeners. The dragon reborn. We are to kill him, great lord? That from the Shinaran, hand grasping eagerly at his side where his sword would hang. Perhaps, Baalzamon said simply, and perhaps not. Perhaps he can be turned to my use. Sooner or later it will be so, in this age or another. Already a bend is forming in the pattern, one of many points where he who will become the dragon may be turned to my service, must be turned. Better that he serve me alive than dead, but alive or dead, serve me he must and will. These three you must know, for each is a thread in the pattern I mean to weave, and it will be up to you to see that they are placed as I command. Study them well, that you will know them. So here we have the unreliable narrator again, as Baalzamon shows them three images that Ingtar instantly recognizes. Boys that he knows well enough by now. He's got to be eating dinner with them every night because they are eating at table with Aglmar, and he must eat with Agilmar. He's one of Agilmar's top lieutenants, if not the top lieutenant. So he's seeing young men there that he may not be exactly fond of, but he probably likes okay, or at least he probably likes Rand and Perrin. He probably doesn't like Matt. He's too serious a person to be fond of Matt, but definitely not young men that he would care to bring to harm. He would not want to harm these boys. And then Ishamael implies that one of them is the dragon. He never says it straight out, but it's not a huge leap to assume it's one of the three when he shows them and immediately says, "The dragon is reborn, Bolo for these three." Bors interprets when Inktar's like, "The dragon reborn, are we going to kill him, great lord?" He interprets his hand grasping eagerly like he's grasping for his sword, and interprets that he's asking if they're to kill the dragon, making it sound like the Shinarin is all pumped to kill the dragon for Baal-Zamon. And I don't think Inktar is pumped about it at all. I think his hand is doing that kind of grasping that's like a tick or something, just an unconscious movement because he's used to having his sword. And I think it's grasping in shock. He knows those boys. He knows that they're Ta'veren because Moraine has not made a secret of that. And now puzzle pieces have fallen into place. Now it makes sense why they went to the Eye of the World when he's like, "They're not warriors. Why the fuck would she take them instead of us?" Because it was almost insulting to him to be like, "You're not allowed to set one foot into the Blight, but these kids get to go with her. What the fuck?" And it makes sense to him what the miracle in the Gap might have been, because all of the soldiers who fought at Tarwyn's Gap are saying, "A miracle, the Creator saved us, yay!" And when the Emmonsfielders, Loyal, Moraine, and Lon show up, they've come back from the Eye of the World, and they're talking to Agilmar about it because Moraine insists on being brought straight to him when they get back. He says they're talking about a miracle in the Gap, but I saw a man, and what he did must not be. It cannot be. So Agilmar early on suspects a man who could channel is what made the difference at the battle at Tarwyn's Gap. And that is also information that Inktar would have been privy to. Inktar is close in Agilmar's council, and I think that news of knowing, no, the Dark One didn't send a miracle. The dragon has been reborn. And if one of those boys is the dragon, and they went to the Eye, and they were saying that the real battle was at the Eye, the dragon saved everybody at the Gap. Inktar isn't a stupid man, and learning this information at the Dark One social, and knowing everything from before about everybody going to the Eye, he had to have known, no, it wasn't the Dark One taking my pledge and being like, "Yo, here you go, here's your wish." And I'm imagining him being left conflicted and reeling and feeling regret and a sense of hope and thinking, "Oh, Light, if I had only known, I never would have gotten that dick tattooed on my face." Then all of the Dark Friends get orders and Bors details their reactions. Some, like Bors, have the true power used to compel them and deep-seat the orders. At the very end of the prologue, there's an intense description of a painful convulsion going through him, and all of this stuff being just crammed into his brain to the point where he can't remember it. And that's compulsion being done with the true power. We also get an external description of it, as Carradine is watching before Baal-Zamon gets to him. He's describing an Illyaner woman. It says, "Suddenly she arched backwards, trembling and rising on her toes. He could not see why she did not fall unless something unseen held her up. Then just as abruptly she settled back to her feet and nodded again, bowing and shivering." Inktar does not get the true power used on him, though. And I think that's because Ishamael only uses it on Dark Friends he has long game planned for. We see what happens in Book 7 when the compulsion is triggered in Jacob Carradine. He sees Matt in Ibudar and has the memories like painfully triggered, everything that has been buried. There's probably no need to use compulsion on Inktar because he's to carry out his orders immediately. His reaction to hearing them is described in this incomplete sentence. It says, "The Shinarin, his stance bespeaking confusion even while he acquiesced." Inktar is given two tasks. He confesses the first of them to Rand at the end of the story. "I never knew what he was going to do," Inktar said softly as if talking to himself. He had his sword out, testing the edge with his thumb. "A pale little man you didn't seem to really notice even when you were looking at him. Take him inside Faldara, I was told, inside the fortress. I did not want to, but I had to do it. You understand? I had to. I never knew what he intended until he shot that arrow. I still don't know if it was meant for the Amaralin or for you. For his second task, it's never in the story explicitly stated that Ingtar freed Padden Fain, but it does say so in the Wheel of Time Companion. So the Shadow Spawn invade the keep, Rand is woken up from his nap, the alarm bells in the keep go off, and he goes running to the dungeons because he knows that Egwene has gone to visit Padden Fain. Ingtar has to have a shortcut to the dungeons, because he comes upon Rand as Rand is heading down there, and Rand has been stopped by running into a fae that has killed 7 men. And it says, "This one is mine, Rand." Rand gave a start as Ingtar stepped up beside him, dark and stocky in a yellow feast day coat, sword held in both hands. Ingtar's dark eyes never left the fae's face. If the Shinaran felt the fear of that gaze, he gave no sign. "Try yourself on a trolloc or two," he said softly, "before you face one of these. I was coming down to see if Egwene is safe. She was going to the dungeon to visit Fain and then go see to her." Rand swallowed. "We'll take it together, Ingtar. You aren't ready for this. Go see to your girl. Go! You want trollocs to find her unprotected?" For a moment, Rand hung there, undecided. The Fade had raised its sword for Ingtar. A silent snarl twisted Ingtar's mouth, but Rand knew it was not fear. And Egwene could be alone in the dungeon with Fain, or worse. Still, he felt ashamed as he ran for the stairs that led underground. He knew a Fade's look could make any man afraid, but Ingtar had conquered the dread. His stomach still felt knotted. The corridors beneath the keep were silent and feebly lit by flickering far-spaced lamps on the walls. He slowed as he came closer to the dungeons, creeping as silently as he could on his toes. The grate of his boots on the bare stone seemed to fill his ears. The door to the dungeon stood cracked open a handbreadth. It should have been closed and bolted. So, at the end of Chapter 5, there is a small POV from Padden Fain. It says, "Pitch blackness covered the dungeons, whatever the hour, unless someone brought in a lantern, but Padden Fain sat on the edge of his cot, staring into the dark with a smile on his face. He could hear the other two prisoners grumbling in their sleep, muttering in nightmares. Padden Fain was waiting for something. Something he had been awaiting for a long time. For too long. But not much longer. The door to the outer guardroom opened, spilling in a flood of light, darkly outlining a figure in the doorway. Fain stood. "You? Not who I expected." He stretched with a casualness he did not feel. Blood raced through his veins. He thought he could leap over the keep if he tried. "Surprises for everyone, eh? Well, come on. The night's getting old, and I want some sleep sometime." As a lamp came into the cell chamber, Fain raised his head, grinning at something unseen yet felt beyond the dungeon's stone ceiling. "It isn't over yet," he whispered. "The battle's never over." A first-time reader, not knowing that this scene is taking place during the battle that we get in the next chapter, could be forgiven for assuming that it's happening whenever, because there's no description of the alarm bells ringing, and there is more problematically no description of Matt and Egwene outside of the cell. This has to be a mistake. It would be one thing to have no mention of them, like you could rationalize that, but they would most assuredly not be sitting there visiting him in the dark. And honestly, considering the fact that Borderlanders work so hard to keep all the lamps lit in the streets, having the dungeons be pitch black seems to be a major oversight. So if we did not know at this point in time, or after the fact, that Ingtar was the one that freed Fain, we would not know that Rand, who Fain is looking up at the ceiling and looking at, was on his way to the dungeon. So Ingtar had to have had a shortcut for him to be so far ahead of Rand. I found an interview snippet on Theoryland where someone asked Robert Jordan what happened with Matt and Egwene and Fain, and he replied, "Most of it is fairly obvious, I would think, and for the rest, read and find out." So, if it's fairly obvious, then I will make a guess. And I would guess that Ingtar went to the door of the dungeon and knocked on it. When Rand and Egwene go earlier in the day, the door is described as having a grill in it with a clapper hanging below. The guards would have recognized Ingtar, and they would have let him into the guardroom no problem. And then the Fade slipped in and really quickly killed them. At some point, Trollocs had to have come in because there were chewed lumps of flesh from the guards' bodies all over the place. Like, only the heads were there and the lumps of flesh at the time that Rand came in, so I don't even know where the rest of their bodies went. While Ingtar opens the inner door to the cell corridor, the Murdral writes the dark prophecy on the wall. Blood feeds blood, blood calls blood. RJ specifically said that the Murderer is the one who wrote the Dark Prophecy, and he wrote it as a threat. Because Trollocs are loud and scary, I'd guess that they probably didn't come into the dungeon until after Ingtar got to the end of the corridor by Fane's cell. Otherwise, Matt and Egwene would be freaking out. But I don't know, depending on whether the Fade was able to silently kill the guards, or whether there was a commotion, I think that Matt and Egwene were at the least really confused, and possibly absolutely terrified. But they trust Ingtar, and he would have reassured them so that he could get close enough to disable them. And I think he would have rendered Matt unconscious first, and then Egwene. Moraine, when she's delving them, makes a note that Egwene was struck on the head and that she's fine. She was just hit here. She never mentions that Matt was hit anywhere in particular, but I think that's just because she's focusing on, oh shit, this is a hell of a lot more serious, the dagger is missing. I think Ingtar was making sure to keep them as safe as he possibly could. I think he was already just fucking sick with himself. I don't think that in becoming a Dark Friend he ever thought that he would have to betray Faldara Keep. And while it's pretty clear that he was not the one who slew the guards at the Dog Gate so that the Trollocs and the Fade were able to get into the Keep, having to basically act like a Trojan horse so that Shadowspawn can get into the guard room and kill two of his compatriots is almost as terrible. And I think that he loathed himself for that. And he would have done anything he could to protect kids, basically helpless kids, and particularly to protect a woman. I think he would have killed the Fade and killed Fane rather than let them hurt Egwene. But I don't think Fane would have hurt Egwene. I think that they had a rapport as such that while he's a horrible, evil piece of shit, I don't think he would have harmed her unless she was in his way. Ingtar may have had to keep him from killing Matt. I think he would have killed Matt, but Ingtar is probably like, we've got to fucking go now, move your ass, because he knew that Rand was on his way, and however good a shortcut into the dungeon that Ingtar had, Rand probably only missed him and the Trollocs and the Fade by like a minute or two. I'm guessing that they had fewer than 5 minutes total to get in there, kill the guards, have the Trollocs eat the guards, write the prophecy on the wall, conk Egwene and Matt on the head, let Fane out, then Fane stole the dagger, and then he wrote Rand the love note in blood on the inner corridor door. We'll meet again on Tommen Head, it's never over. And I'm assuming at that point there would be Trollocs inside the guard room having a quick snack and maybe divvying up the rest of the guards' bodies to eat later. Maybe that's what happened to them. And then Fane probably was the one who put their heads on the table, because that's his kind of theater. I don't think Ingtar knew that this would happen. I think that he believed that his betrayal of the Keep would amount to letting the weird little man in and getting Fane out, and that the job of getting Fane out would be a mission undertaken quietly, not something so outrageously violent. And I doubt that it ever occurred to him that the horn would be taken. After they get all the Shadowspawn out of the Keep, Ingtar heads back to the dungeon and shows up as if it's the first time, like playing dumb. And he says, "What happened here, Randalthor?" Rand shook his head. "I don't know, except that Fane escaped somehow, and hurt Egwene and Matt doing it. I saw the guard room," he shuddered, "but in here..." "Whatever it was, Ingtar, it scared that fellow bad enough that he hung himself. I think the other one's gone mad from seeing it. We are all going mad tonight. The Fade. You killed it?" "No." Ingtar slammed his sword into its sheath. The hilt stuck up above his right shoulder. He seemed angry and ashamed at the same time. "It's out of the Keep by now, along with the rest of what we could not kill. At least you're alive, Ingtar. That Fade killed 7 men. "Alive? Is that so important?" Suddenly, Ingtar's face was no longer angry, but tired and full of pain. "We had it in our hands. In our hands! And we lost it, Rand. Lost it!" He sounded as if he could not believe what he was saying. "Lost what?" Rand asked. "The horn. The horn of Valyr. It's gone, chest and all." I always wondered if Fane had used one of his weird abilities that he has, and that is what fucked up the other prisoners and made them go all batshit. But I was poking around on Theory Land, and I found this lovely piece of an interview that Robert Jordan gave, which gives us an idea of what informed his thinking. It says, There were two prisoners in the cells with Fane, both of them bordermen who had some knowledge of Shadowspawn. And in the heart of the fortress, here comes a troop of Trollocs, and the light alone knows what else. Put yourself in their place. Put yourself in a cage. You can't get out. You are in the dark. And here comes your worst nightmares walking in. Only it's worse than nightmares, because you know that these nightmares are real. You know what they do to human beings. You know they sometimes keep people alive a long time so they can have fresh meat. People don't need arms or legs to survive, so they can feed off you for days, maybe weeks, and you can't get out. You can't get away. You just have to shiver in your cage and watch them open up another of the cages, while you wonder whether they're going to open your cage, too. How do you escape? How can you get away? Maybe suicide is an option? At least it's quick. Quicker, anyway, but make up your mind fast, sport. While you're dithering, your mind might decide to make its own escape. That won't stop you from being butchered slowly, but at least you won't know it's happening. So that's dark, but it does make a lot of sense. RJ is always nice enough to do a lot of that stuff off screen, so that even if we really want to think about all the shit that goes on with the Trollocs and the Murdrel and the terror inherent in dealing with them, we only get to see it every once in a while. They are truly fucking awful. I'm hoping the TV show is judicious in its use of the horror elements, because things are scarier if you don't overdo them. And also, I can't handle a ton of gore. But if I have to have, you know, gore and awfulness, I'd rather have it in monstrous form. I couldn't handle more than a couple of seasons of Game of Thrones, because I just can't deal with human cruelty. I need to have it wrapped up in a monster. It's less distressing. But speaking of distress, Ingtar's distress, mentioning the theft of the horn, is genuine. I did a Twitter poll to try to figure out when Ingtar repented and decided that he wanted to come back to the light. And 79% of people said that it was after Flicker Flicker. But I think that he decided he wanted to come back to the light before the horn was stolen. I think getting the guards to let him into the dungeon so the Murdrel could murder them would have broken something inside him. There are such fundamental values of steadfastness and faith and honor and having each other's back that are just part of being a borderman. And I feel like just spitting on that, violating those values. There are plenty of borderlanders who are dark friends, but those are borderlanders who want certain things that they think being a dark friend can give them. Immortality, power, money, people filled with greed or a desire for vengeance, people who are cruel, who want excuses for bad behavior. None of those things drive Ingtar. And so having to commit an act of betrayal like that, especially going back to the keep after the Dark Friend Social, knowing the dragon has been reborn, he would have looked at their bodies, he would have looked at the blood, and he would have been filled with so much self-loathing, and he would have thought, I never wanted this. As they chase the horn and they get into the second day, Padden Fane and the Fade have been engaging in a battle of wills. Fane is insisting that they go south, and the Fade is struggling to bring the horn to Shael Ghul, which is what Ishamael intended. On the first day, they went straight south, and then they begin to zigzag. And as they zigzag, bodies are left at each stop, each place that they're doing a direction change. And Ingtar flat out refuses to bury the bodies. They come across a dead Shinaran who's had the back of his head bashed in, and he's like, we're not going to waste time burying dark friends. Just filled with disgust, like no forgiveness. He won't forgive them because there's so much of himself that I think he can't forgive. But when they come across the flayed corpses of Changu and Nadao, they do take the time to bury them. And maybe it's partly because they are soldiers and because they are their compatriots. So it's sort of like they can at least take them down and do the simple courtesy of putting them in a hole, especially because there's so little involved in actually burying someone with Shinaran ritual. But Loyal tells Rand that he does not think anyone will say the benediction for the departed that is part of Shinaran beliefs. He thinks it's obvious they had to have killed the guards at the dog gate and let the Trollocs in. But it says, Before they rode away, Ingtar paused on his horse beside the unmarked graves, two mounds of bare earth that looked too small to hold men. After a moment, he said, "The light shine on you, and the Creator shelter you. The last embrace of the Mother welcome you home." When he raised his head, he looked at each man in turn. There was no expression on any face, least of all on Ingtar's. "They saved Lord Aglmar at Tarwin's Gap," he said. Several of the Lancers nodded. In that, Ingtar sees hope for himself. He would want someone to bless his grave. He would want to be thought to have done enough good to deserve some manner of redemption. He feels like if he can grant them enough grace to be like, "They saved Lord Aglmar. Obviously they're dark friends, but they did that one thing, you know, even in the midst of the shadow. They could have let Lord Aglmar die, but they did not. They had that amount of honor. They had that amount of good in them, regardless of what else they've done. And I will say that prayer for them in the hopes that someone will grant me the same courtesy, the same redemption, to grant me something in the hopes that it would be enough." But he comes to see that it is not enough. The longer that the horn is out of their hands, the more desperate he is to find it, and the more he must hate himself, especially because he knows that the dragon is reborn, and he had to have been asking himself if he, weak-willed and despairing as he was with his fucked-up logic, I think that he probably was drinking, because people who are drinking make dumb choices. People under the influence do dumb things. I think about Massima in the Fires of Heaven as he's in full prophet mode, talking about places of strong drink and places with loose women, basically brothels and bars, and how he frequented those places in his days of sin. I feel like drinking and wenching is probably very common for Shinarin soldiers because they don't have a lot of ways to blow off steam, and that it's perhaps not talked about very much, but if you don't have men that are prone to get married, and you have men who, while they're on duty, stay focused on duty, none of the men are drinking while they're hunting for the horn, and perhaps drinking is generally looked down upon because you need to be ready to fight at all times in the Borderlands. And so it's one of those cycles where you drink too much, and you're filled with self-loathing. I don't know, maybe he was dead sober when he made the choice, but it doesn't seem like something a sober person would choose to do. Regardless, he knows the dragon is reborn, and at the same time he has bound himself to a path that forces acts out of him, where the unintended consequences of those acts, the horn being stolen, spell doom for the world. If he can't unfuck it, if he can't fix it, it spells doom for the world, just as he knows that there's actually a reason to hope. And so while everyone was tortured during the portal journey to Toman Head, Ingtar was one of the people who was most traumatized by the journey. You know, you got Perrin digging his hands into his eyes, Matt curls up in a ball, Massima is openly weeping, and Ingtar is telling Varen, "I walk in the light, I do." It says, "Rand, when Varen brought us here with the portal stone, I lived other lives. Sometimes I held the horn, but I never sounded it. I tried to escape what I'd become, but I never did. Always there was something else required of me. Always something worse than the last, until I was... You were ready to give it up to save a friend. Think not of the glory. Oh, light, help me." Rand did not know what to say. It was as if Egwene had told him she had murdered children. Too horrible to be believed. Too horrible for anyone to admit to unless it was true. Too horrible. After a time, Ingtar spoke again firmly. "There has to be a price, Rand. There is always a price. Perhaps I can pay it here. Ingtar, it is every man's right, Rand, to choose when to sheath the sword, even one like me." And imagine the sacrifice here, really, because the Dark One rules in death, so there will likely be no respite for him. Ingtar is basically choosing to walk into hell. For a dark friend to willfully embrace death in contravention to their master's desires means accepting torment. Suicide is not an escape, which is one of the most horrible things about the Wheel of Time, honestly. RJ often explores the notion of suicide as an escape, but for dark friends in particular, it's like there's no way out. They'll get you even when you're dead. And so even the noble death that Ingtar is embracing, holding a choke point so his friends can escape. "One man could hold 50 here," Ingtar said. The two stables stood close together, with barely room for the pair of them to stand side by side between them. One man holding 50 at a narrow passage. Not a bad way to die. Songs have been made about less. Even that noble death is not an escape. No wonder most dark friends lack moral courage. The idea of eternal torment is horrifying. I cannot imagine believing in hell. How stressful. I feel bad for people who do. Like, that's fucked up. What a fucking scam. How some types of churches or religions manipulate and terrorize people by teaching them to believe something so horrible. But Rand, young Rand, sweet, naive Rand, tells Zingtar that he thinks that no longer wanting to be a dark friend is enough. Like, you can just stop your membership. Like, you can just wash your face and make that dick tattoo no longer a thing. But it's not that easy. And Zingtar knows better. Go, Rand, Zingtar said. He turned to face the street and did not look at Rand or hear it again. Take the horn where it belongs. I always knew the Ammerlin should have given you the charge, but all I ever wanted was to keep Shinar whole, to keep us from being swept away and forgotten. I know, Zingtar. Rand drew a deep breath. The light shine on you, Lord Zingtar of House Shinawa, and may you shelter in the palm of the Creator's hand. He touched Inktar's shoulder. The last embrace of the mother welcome you home.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. Zingtar is one of my favorite minor characters. I think he is one of the things that makes the Great Hunt so special and unique. He's an early example of Robert Jordan showing us that people aren't so simple. And I love his story, and just looking at his motivations, I think he's great. You can find me on Twitter at Warder Gray, that's Gray with an E. All of my links are down there in the show notes if you want to drop me a line, ask me any questions. Join my Discord and check it out. It's a boring Discord. You should come and make it interesting. You should check out WAP Trivia and Games. There are a bunch of cool games there you can play and hang out with some cool people. That's fun to do. You should check out the WAP fandom and calendar if you want to find a bunch more content creators. Please rate and review me on Apple Music. That would mean a lot to me. And if you could tell some friends about me, I'd appreciate that too. Word of mouth always really helps. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. I'm the Grey Warder. And I know to pledge yourself to the Shadow, all you have to say is, I wish the Dark One would come and take my soul away. Right now. That's not hard, is it?